I have to say that I'm absolutely not a political person. I don't have that sort of background. You know, in my undergraduate years, I definitely I saw activism as something that activists do, and the rest of us sort of go about and do our own business. We study our own things and so forth. So it was probably just over the last 4 years that I really felt, the need for change, and just felt how pressing that need was, and how each one of us, I guess, needs to be an activist. And that's how I got involved. I mean, I absolutely believe so much in Barack Obama's, I guess, core values and the ideas that he represents, and also just the power he has to inspire people. I mean, that same rally in Nashua, and I mean, it was kind of like a rock concert, you know, like he was just, he took over the crowd, and there was so much excitement, and it was like, it was really electrifying. Yeah, but you know, he had this presence that, you know, just filled up the entire high school gym. For example, I mean, I'd say that my values and my ideology, my ideas just align so closely with what he has to say. And I particularly like, you know, his approach, I'd say, to foreign policy, which is, you know, one of talking to everyone at the table and not just, you know, it's a very different approach probably than the one we've seen in the last 4 or 8 years.
Well, to begin with, I'm a senior politics major at Princeton, so it sort of made sense for me to come here. I've noticed recently that a lot of my friends don't necessarily find it that important to actually vote, even those who are politics majors, and it seems sort of counterintuitive. So when this trip came along, we basically had the choice of coming, basically, the bill is being footed by two different organizations through Princeton and helping us get here. And so it became this amazing opportunity to really talk to, take pictures with, be in the presence of these people who will have the biggest impact on our country over the next 4 years. And then for me, the why Hillary question, every time I go to a door and knock on it and someone will give me 2 seconds to actually say something, that's what I say to them. So my pitch is that I truly believe in her, her experience and her strength as a person to bring about those policy issues, be it healthcare, energy, withdrawing from Iraq. And I think I wish, and when I left the school,
represent the educated class. They can hardly make any kind of coherent argument whatsoever. This is unbelievable. I believe in Barack, his core values, ideas he represents, and his power to inspire, without going into what core values you believe he represents. It just turns into a rock concert, as you say. Oh, who's Barack supposed to be? Hendrix? This is pathetic. Then the other one talks about how she likes being in the pictures of these characters. Being in the presence of them. Taking pictures with them. You like their idea of approach. What does this mean? When they're all part of the imperial agenda. Good night. I leave Sam's plantation for a little while, come back, and it's worse than ever. Well, here we go for another year. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org, with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1, 96.3, check out propagandapress.org and radioforall.net, the universe. Tonight, we're going to go into an issue of the insanity of this voting game. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Spiral of American politics, life, and humanity appears to have no bottom surface in sight. Deeper than hell has the American ethic and way of being plunged. In a point in time where proper, quote-unquote, participation in American politics is defined by an elite class and swallowed whole by most in this gumpified populace. As voting for one imperial candidate or another in this horrific state of American political affairs and conditions knows no limit, hell seems the only destiny for humanity. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called Voting on the Edge of Insanity, Hillary and Barack, Imperial Feminism, and the Modified Mulattified Negro. We're going to try to address some of these issues at hand. Questions like, by who and why was this electoral system set up? Whose interest is it in? Whose interest does it really serve? When was it set up throughout American history? Is it really, quote unquote, for those who believe in this system, one person, one vote? What was the racial and gender terms in the development of this electoral and delegate system in the primaries and in and during the presidential elections? And how did this come about? Did slavery, the Civil War, play a factor in this? And is the electoral process state to state the same? And if not, why? And how was it decided during different periods of times who can and who could not vote? can felons vote in all states, in no states, or in certain states? And what was the development of those? One must also ask, especially black people in this day and time, what good has come from Negro candidates, office holders, in this dollar and chain system? And the color gender dynamic in this primary race, how is it being played out and interpreted in predictable ways? Is it symbolism? Is it real access for the masses and upward humanitarian mobility? Some of these issues and more we're going to try to address as we move along. But first, let's start off with a debate between Glenn Ford and Michael Eyre Dyson. They were both on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now! And let us break down some of these dynamics as they were both going back and forth on discussing the Obama presidency. Dyson, Michael Eyre Dyson, supports Obama. Let's start off with Dyson as he addresses Obama in the aftermath of Obama's loss in New Hampshire after Obama first won Iowa. So let's check this out and take it from there.
Well, I think, as you pointed out, that Barack Obama was predicted to be far behind initially in this race. And then, of course, the pollsters got it wrong in terms of his overwhelming victory. But I think a couple of things. First of all, there may be more a bit of play here of telling pollsters one thing, what they expect to hear when it comes to race, not simply because people have racist intent, but because of the historic lag between publicly identifying and embracing a person of color, in this case a black man, who is transcending what they believe to be race to represent the entire swath of the population on the one hand, and the persistence of a kind of resistance and skepticism on the other. We don't know how that'll play out, we'll see. But secondly, I think that in his speech about Yes We Can, obviously he had tailored that speech for victory, but I think what he is pointing to among his followers and the people who support him is that it was still nonetheless an extraordinary victory in overcoming such initial odds against him, and then moving forward. His eye was on the future, so to speak, in Nevada and in South Carolina, where this debate will be waged bitterly, where the campaign battle is on. And I think Barack Obama has extraordinary momentum regardless of the perceived of the loss last night. That loss last night didn't lose him many more delegates, but at least the perception of being the inevitable nominee for the Democratic Party. But I think Barack Obama has extraordinary wind behind his wings and will obviously ascend much higher.
Well, first off, you know, Dyson is just framing it like a horse race. You know, the extraordinary odds against him, but he'll ascend much higher. This is not talking about the substance. But when you get down to some of the wordplay that Dyson gets into, it becomes even more problematic. When Dyson talks about this may be a thing of people saying one thing to pollsters, i.e. they're saying that they're going to vote for Obama, telling people what they want or expect to hear. Well, first off, why would they want or expect to hear this? Because talking about white people saying that they were going to vote for Obama, because all along, at least in initial stages, Hillary was projected as the winner. Later, it became Obama being projected as the winner. But why would people tell these pollsters what they quote-unquote were expecting to hear, i.e., yeah, I'm a vote for Obama, when, in fact, it had been projected earlier that Hillary was in the dominant position. But Dyson doesn't address this. It's this kind of a wordplay game that we'll see goes on and on. Then Dyson goes on and saying, you know, that these people vote the other way, ended up voting the other way, not because of racist intent, maybe because of the historical lag, i.e. publicly endorsing a person of color. The historical lag. Well, if you're talking about the historical lag, there's a historical issue where whites have historically said that they would vote for a black candidate, and there was a up to like a 15% gap in them really doing this. But I don't know if you would call this a lag. He's acting like there's some kind of progression that is taking place for a better environment on racial grounds, when in reality there is no real structural social evidence to prove that overall. Now, anyway, how honest is the verbal claim of supporting a black candidate, quote unquote black candidate, yet voting the other way? One would argue not very. And Dyson can't say that that's not based off of racism or not, because Dyson nor anyone knows what is, you know, the real intent and the mindset of these people. And that's on top of the fact that New Hampshire could have easily been a stolen, primary race. There is good evidence that something did suspicious happen, which this shows how, once again, there are so many overlapping areas because the system itself is so decrepit. It is so sinister. But, you know, when you're one of these Negro types that want to play along with the system, you get into this kind of jargon. Then Dyson goes that, many whites see Obama as a black person who they believe is transcending what they believe to be race, to represent all people. Now, Obama's game of quote-unquote transcending race to represent all people is to avoid talking about black issues and black concerns of injustice, primarily, like a plague. As Obama likes to say, no black America. There is no Latin America. There's only a United States of America. Now, we all know that he couldn't and wouldn't say there's no rich America or there's no poor America. So how is there a United States of America? A United States, you know, figuratively in the concept of a cohesion. Obviously, there is not a unity on a class issue, on a humanistic, social, political issue. There is exploitation on this issue. And by avoiding components of the racial issue, you are avoiding aspects of the class and social political issue. So Obama is not really, quote unquote, representing transcending race. He's a representative of someone who is trying to transcend blackness. He's playing the game of post-racial reality, which means that the issues of blackness are politically subordinated to the point of not addressing them. In the past, black people have faced similar types of issues during Jim Crow, when the crushing power of Jim Crow had many whites say that there is no racial problem in the South, and that people who came down to organize in the South were just agitating their Negroes. Because after all, everything was all good. It was a post-racial environment. This is a similar thing that is trying to be projected. And Dyson is trying to pretend, in part, that, a white support of a candidate like Barack represents a positive transformation, without dealing with the fact that Obama has had to tactically avoid offending much of white America's privileges and sensibilities. And remember, Dyson said that Obama is believed to be transcending race, which really is transcending black, which is a component of the class aspect of the American experience. But in the same way that they try to project that America is in a stage of permanent capitalism, it has transcended all other ideologies and so on and so forth, this is another aspect of that manifestation. In essence, Obama is playing the role of the mulatto savior, the mulattified messenger. He represents all of us at the same time. That's how it's often projected. And within this kind of projection, Obama, the fact that Obama is a Democrat, and as a Democrat, an administrator, a senator for the Imperial Order, he clearly doesn't represent all people. He doesn't represent all people in this country, and he certainly doesn't represent the interests of the masses of humanity. He is involved in an institution of imperial scope that crushes over the lives of people worldwide. A poor black person voting for Obama, a rich black person voting for Obama, a poor white or rich white, a minimum wage, a black Latino, a billionaire white, a union worker, a union breaker, can all pull the lever for Obama, the great unifier, as is projected. But the questions that have historically been shown and are currently overly apparent is, who does this benefit? Who does he really serve is ignored. There is in this society a form of voting in an optical illusion. In reality, voting in this system is the political masses of people's concession to the dominant entities. Voting in this society is the political tactic of the elite corporate class and those who serve them. Because by the masses participating in this illusion, it helps legitimize this system. And it helps siphon off the energy that should collectively be engaged in by the masses. So Obama helps serve as a form of A Negro Camelot. Brzezinski is one of Obama's advisors. Brzezinski is one of the legendary figures, grand chessboard strategist on the world imperial stage. Brzezinski, who worked with Carter during the Carter administration, is legendary for his tactical upheavals of states and competing forces in the Eurasian, the landmass of Europe and Asia combined, as a tactical battle for energy takes place. As Brzezinski has written in his grand chessboard book, anyone who has the backing of Brzezinski or is aligned with him is clearly an imperial tactical tactician themselves. But let's now go to Ford, who responds to Dyson, followed again by Dyson responding to Ford. Check this.
Ford, your response to the New Hampshire loss and the Iowa victory.
Well, it wasn't really a loss. He only lost by a couple of points. I think with New Hampshire and Iowa, Barack Obama has won a great, unprecedented historical victory in proving that he can win the support of huge numbers of white people in essentially white primaries. And by doing that, he has accomplished the central mission of his entire campaign, which is to prove that a black man can be embraced by masses of white people. The problem is he has done that at the expense of black people by constantly, relentlessly sending out signals to white people that a vote for Barack Obama, an Obama presidency, would signal the beginning of the end of black-specific agitation, that it would take race discourse off of the table. And he's gone to extraordinary lengths to accomplish that. He said things that white Democrats that no white Democrat would ever say. For example, the ridiculous statement that blacks had already come 90% of the way on the road to equality, with the implicit idea that a vote for him would take black people the other 10% of the way. It's a ridiculous statement. It's based on no substance whatsoever. No indexes show blacks 90% of the way towards equality in any area of life. We've never made 65% more in income than white people. Black median household wealth is 1/10 white median household wealth, and on and on and on and on. In fact, we can't find 90% figures relevant outside of NBA teams and prison. No white man, no white Democrat who said that would avoid being excoriated by the entire spectrum of black political
opinion. Professor Dyson, your response.
Well, I think that there's no question that the politics of race when it comes to Barack Obama are complicated. There is the repudiation of a certain narrow conception of skin nationalism when it comes to race. And yet, if you look at Audacity of Hope, where Barack Obama discusses the issue of race, is a much more nuanced and complex comprehension of the racial factors that remain. I obviously share, as a person who's written greatly and a great deal about race, that certainly we are not in the promised land by any measure. But I think what Barack Obama is pointing to is the fact that as a person who can carry the water for not only African-American people, but for the American population, the notion that a black man can be president then has to be put squarely in front of the American population, at least on the table. On the other hand, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and other political critics and activists are not going to be out of job when Barack Obama becomes president. I think there's an illusory notion that perhaps Mr. Ford might want to at least pay more strict attention to, and that is the fact that there's a bifocal vision going on here. Barack Obama's ascent to the presidency doesn't destroy black poverty, radical inequality, social injustice, the need to pay attention to all of those issues that he should be held accountable for once he ascends to the presidency. My support of Barack Obama is not predicated upon a denial of the legitimacy of social critique arguing for the development and betterment of African-American people. So I think we have to keep our eyes on both of those issues at the same time.
Okay, once again, you know, when Dyson goes into this stuff about how the politics of race become complicated, there is, by Obama, a repudiation of skin nationalism when it comes to race. Well, first of all, there is no repudiation of quote-unquote skin nationalism when it comes to white elitism. And when it comes to how the construct of whiteness is an elite political, social, economic, patriarchal construct within itself. Obama is not any kind of repudiation of any kind of skin nationalism as Dyson is trying to project. Basically, Obama tries to project a form of post-blackness, i.e. race neutralism. And within that context, if you are race neutral, color-based neutral, then you are class-based neutral, because the issue of color intersects with class, just like the issue of gender intersects with class. So if you try to claim that the issues of women's rights are basically taken care of, you are gender neutral, you know, it's a post-gender time, then basically you are playing a similar game. See, what Obama really represents is someone who avoids the racial issues, so that when you avoid these types of racial issues, you avoid the class aspect of these racial-based issues. So, Genesis, Hurricane Sam in New Orleans, the Congo issue, Haiti, and how these all intersect in the policies and how they are played out and projected and how people respond to them are not just a class-based thing, but how the color class issues intersect with each other. Obama, for himself, represents he's a representative of someone who comes at it from the color Negro professional administrative class aspect, i.e. he's there for his own professional ascendancy to office, higher office holding, you know, senator, mayor, governors, etc., etc. And he plays within the tune of this particular elite class order. And by this alignment, he is not only a servant to the imperial elite on class issues, but is a useful tool and operative on the racial issues and trying to make a coherent argument and collective organizing on a grander scale by people who are oppressed in the clash racial ways, neutralized. He and people like Tiger Woods, well, basically Obama would be Tiger Woods if he played golf, and Tiger Woods would be him. They both tried to avoid the dynamics of it. But at the same time, they tried to project themselves, especially Obama, as someone who, by their mere image, being in that particular position, that this is somehow representative of people transcending these issues in a positive way and a step forward for not only black people and white people, but for all humanity. It's this Negro illusion games. This is a modified version, a modified, molodified version. Now, Dyson then goes in to look at the book Audacity of Hope and how Barack discusses issues of race, which are much more nuanced and complex and comprehensive of the racial factors that remain. Now, it is very possible, I haven't checked out this book, but it is very possible that, and probable on a certain level, that Obama understands more thoroughly the dynamics of racism within this given society and how it is connected to the economic order. But that doesn't mean he has an allegiance with the masses of people who are being crushed within this system. In the same way that the FBI has a racial profile of Black America, and out of Conoco, Virginia, they have a script set up based off of this racial profile on how to respond when Black people are gunned down, like, you know, Sean Bell or Amadou Diallo, or tortured like Abner Louima, and on and on and on. And basically, they advise the governors and mayors and all of that to have large meetings and, you know, call over so-called Negro leaders who basically are helping to stamp out the flames, the Jesse Jacksons, the Al Sharptons, and to have them say, look, I met with the mayor, I met with the governor. He promises me that they're going to have an exploratory commission on what happened. He promises me that they're going to investigate this issue and prosecute if necessary to the fullest detail. And this will help dissipate the Black masses of people organizing independently amongst themselves to come with real crystallized solutions. So here is the FBI doing a psychological profile on Black people, not for the benefit of Black people, but to help neutralize Black people from crystallizing issues and coming with answers and solutions that are the alternative of the state's wishes. So the fact that Obama could understand more complexly the issues that Black people face doesn't mean that that means he is on the side of resolving these issues. It's quite probable that Obama understands just the basic class dynamics more deeply and how the average citizen in America is getting crushed under the hooves of the corporate elite. But that doesn't mean that he then, by his understanding, aligns with those masses, because he's clearly someone who is in the pockets of the corporate overlords. Now, when one thinks about Obama's points and how he points to the fact that a person who can carry the water for, you know, Dyson says that Obama is, you know, being projected as a person who can not only carry water for Black people, but the American population. Then the notion of Obama becoming president has to be taken seriously. What Dyson is basically doing by breaking it down like that is he's giving legitimacy to the imperial order. Because by saying that since Obama can quote-unquote carry the water for not only Black people but the American population, and since it is now being perceived he can do that, and we can, of course, obviously shatter that, but that means that Obama can be taken seriously, ignores the fact that the water that he's really carrying is not in the interest of the masses of people, but it is projected in a way that is counter to even Dyson's own little hero, like Martin Luther King, who was raising concerns late in his life about the imperial context of war that the U.S. government operates in. And at that time, of course, it was the Vietnam War. So with ignoring these types of factors, all Dyson does is just reduce it down to some form of a horse race. And how best to get people to believe in your so-called vision without any dealing with any of the racial dynamics or the hard class economic dynamics. It's just forms of a sophistry being played out. Now, Dyson then goes into how, you know, with Obama becoming president, is not going to destroy black poverty, social injustice, radical inequality, and how his support of Barack is not predicated on a denial of the legitimacy of social critique and arguing for development of, you know, black people. Well, then why are you supporting Obama? I mean, you admit that Obama will not destroy poverty, racial inequality, social justice, and you haven't even presented how he would even challenge it in the least bit or pose any kind of challenge. The American populace standard of living over the last 25 years has continued to go down under both Democrats and Republicans. How would Obama make any difference? The reality is that Dyson and all these types that are supporting Obama can't come out with any evidence that anything that he is politically aligned with would make any kind of difference. And that the dollar and chain system that we live in, and the dollar being part of the dominance that the U.S. has on the world stage, and that the dollar is tied into energy resources the world over being exchanged in dollar currencies, and how that is now under threat, and that one of the pivotal ways, the key way that the U.S. can maintain the dollar system being propped up through the world's energy resources being exchanged through the U.S. dollar is by imperial war of aggression and dominating by imperial force the area, the land masses, so that the resources will still be under the control of the U.S. domination. It doesn't mean that these resources come, all these resources come to America, is that how they are exchanged. So controlling the piping routes, controlling the choke points throughout the planet, and controlling areas like Iraq, where there are large quantities of hydrocarbons, is a key component in making sure that the dollar is the primary currency that the world trades in its energy. If the world continues to use and project itself into using alternative monetary currencies or a basket of currencies, one of the great pillars of U.S. domination, the dollar, will crumble. And if the dollar crumbles, the military crumbles. And if and when that happens, the U.S. will cease to be the world dominant empire. Nothing that Barack is about would challenge that. And the pharmaceutical companies and healthcare products who place Hillary as number one in money donations and Barack as number two know this. The commercial banks that give Hillary number one and Barack number two know this. These are above Republicans and all the other Democrats. Democrats that had been running. The hedge fund corporation, the only one above Hillary and Barack, it was Rudolph Giuliani, followed by Hillary and Barack. And it goes on down the line. In other words, this is how they vote, in part, and how they secure their interests. But here, to further go into this, let's hear from investigative journalist who talks about the advisors of this imperial administration to be Hillary and Barack. Check this out.
Well, I think one thing you could say about the advisors for all the candidates who have a chance is that the presence of these advisors makes it clear that these candidates aren't serious about enforcing the murder laws, and that they're willing to kill civilians, foreign civilians, en masse, in order to advance U.S. policy. And they're not serious about law and order. They're soft on crime. Let's start with Clinton. Madeleine Albright, she was the main force behind the Iraq sanctions that killed more than 400,000 Iraqi civilians. General Wesley Clark, he was the one who ran the bombing of Serbia and the former Yugoslavia, came out and publicly said that he was going after civilian targets like electrical plants, like the TV station there. Richard Holbrooke, in the Carter administration, he was the one who oversaw the shipment of weapons to the Indonesian military as they were illegally invading East Timor and killing a third of the population there. And he was the one who kept the UN Security Council from enforcing its resolution against that invasion. Strobe Talbot, he was the one who, during the Clinton administration, oversaw Russia policy, a backing of Yeltsin, which resulted in turning over the national wealth to the oligarchs and a drop in life expectancy in much of Russia of about 15 years, massive death. And you have various backers of the Iraq invasion and occupation and the recent escalation, people like General Jack Keane, Michael O'Hanlon, and others. That's just Clinton. Well, Obama's top advisor is Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski gave an interview to the French press a number of years ago where he boasted about the fact that it was he who created the whole Afghan jihadi movement, the movement that produced Osama bin Laden. And he was asked by the interviewer, well, don't you think this might have had some bad consequences? And Brzezinski replied, absolutely not. It was definitely worth it because we were going after the Soviets. We were getting the Soviets. During Bill Clinton's administration, during the Bosnia killing, the U.S. actually flew some of the Afghan Mujahideen, the early al-Qaeda people. The U.S. actually arranged for them to be flown from there to Bosnia to fight on the Muslim NATO side. Another key Obama advisor, Anthony Lake, he was the main force behind the U.S. Invasion of Haiti in the mid-Clinton years, during which they brought back Aristide, essentially in political chains, a pledge to support a World Bank, IMF overhaul of the economy, which resulted in an increase in malnutrition deaths among Haitians, and set the stage for the current ongoing political disaster in Haiti. Another Obama advisor, General Merrill McPeak, an Air Force man, who not long after the Dili massacre in East Timor in 91, he was, I happened to see on Indonesian TV shortly after that, there was General McPeak overseeing the delivery to Indonesia of U.S. Fighter planes. Another key Obama advisor, Dennis Ross. Ross, for many years under both Clinton and Bush II, he has advised Clinton and both Bushes. He oversaw U.S. policy toward Israel-Palestine. He pushed the principle that the legal rights of the Palestinians, the rights recognized under international law, must be subordinated to the needs of the state of the Israeli government. In other words, their desires to expand, to do whatever they want in the occupied territories. And Ross was one of the people who, interestingly, led the political assault on former Democratic President Jimmy Carter. No peacenik. I mean, Carter is the one who bears ultimate responsibility for that Timor terror that Holbrooke was involved in. But Ross led an assault on him because, regarding Palestine, Carter was so bold as to agree with Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa that what Israel was doing in the occupied territories was tantamount to apartheid. And so Ross was one of those who fiercely attacked him. Another Obama advisor, Sarah Sewell, who heads a human rights center at Harvard and is a former defense official, she wrote the introduction to General Petraeus's Marine Corps Army counterinsurgency handbook, the handbook that is now being used worldwide by U.S. troops in various killing operations. That's the Obama team.
So once again, this puts the reality to all of the tap dancing and smoke and mirrors that you see people like Dyson engaged in. And it's really quite sickening because they try to present themselves as people who are giving an honest assessment for the interest of not only black people, but humanity in general, when in reality, it's clearly a fraud. It turned out under the whole sanctions game that over a million Iraqis died. And there is a lineage between the sanctions under the Clinton administration that Albright helped facilitate to the Imperial War. That is the physical war that is going on now, where another million plus people have died and millions have been internally displaced and relocated outside of the country. Now, when you have a situation where, Brzezinski, who was the strategist of many things, I talked about him extensively in the Beast Rulers Lock Their Horns in slave episode, and dealt with how his particular strategy, while it is different tactically from the neocons, also both of them have genocidal implications. So it's not so much of one imperial strategy being softer than the other. It's just tactically, how do you put the masses of people in these various regions under your control? And Brzezinski's strategy is more used of economic hitmen, assassinations, sanctions, and so on and so forth, whereas the neocon strategy is basically to break up the various countries in the Middle East and turn them into tribalized subsets, Sunni Iraq, Kurdistan Iraq, Shiite Iraq, so on and so forth, so that they will be more manageable, and it will help the state of Israel's power situation be enhanced even more so. Whereas Brzezinski's colored revolutions, tulip revolutions, orange revolutions, choke point strategy, and all of that type of stuff, all, have the same type of genocidal results and massive upheavals and all of that type of stuff. It's just coming at it in a different, at a different tactical angle and stuff. But as someone who, as he has bragged about himself, helped put together the whole Afghan jihadi movement that CIA operatives like Bin Laden were able to spring from and be a component of the military, the U.S. military PSYOP's political apparatus. His legendary genocidal feats are well established. But it goes on. You have Dennis Ross as Alan Nairn, the journalist just stated, who issues on Palestine have genocidal ramifications. You have Anthony Lake, who helped facilitate the overthrow. And basically all that happened was Aristide was running for office. He offered the people of Haiti Social Security, minimum wage, a retirement program, and things of that nature. The U.S. had a candidate that they ran who basically was a more or less just another structural adjustment type of candidate. And that particular candidate only got 13% of the vote, where Aristide got 67% of the vote. So the U.S., under Anthony Lake and other strategists, went to the next stage, which was to create a terrorist organization called FRAP, led by Emmanuel Constant. They then killed thousands of people, ran Aristide out of the country, and when they brought Aristide back into the country, he was basically in the type of chains, the shackles that he was supposed to be in, you know, and his time was basically up from having any real political influence. But this had genocidal implications that are relevant today when you see Haitian sisters and brothers eating literally mud pies. And this is the type of person that Obama is attached to. These types of genocidal strategists, which gives an indication, more than an indication, of what he's really all about in the real world. Then there's this Saul guy, or woman, who wrote the counterinsurgency handbook that Obama's down with. This is all tied within the whole Salvador solution, the occupational stress disorder tactics that you see playing out in Iraq right now, which I went over in the slave episode, Disposable GIs, and it's part of the permanent war solution. And it also plays into the whole apparatus in the permanent war stage, where you have domestic spying, wiretapping, rendering, indefinite detainment, torture, etc., etc. And you can't have the Salvador solution and all of these types of counterinsurgency tactics and handbooks without having the School of the Americas, which is the legendary school. I know they changed the name. It's all, you know, window dressing. Where most of Latin America's greatest terrorists, henchmen, strongmen, and U.S. Puppet clients get their training to go down and beat down their population. So from this apparatus, which serves the corporate interests, when they go back and beat down the population so that Nike and whoever else wants to go in there and have the population work for 19 cents an hour, to the Haiti situation, which Spalding Baseball, Nestle's Chocolate, and Mickey Mouse were all upset with the audacity of Aristide trying to raise the minimum wage. So this counterinsurgency game, outlined and helped laid out by the Anthony Lakes, Obama's current advisor, helped deconstruct the people's movement to make their lives more livable so that Mickey Mouse can once again have his day in the exploitative sun and garbage of American imperialism and oppression.